got the proceedings underway. For those of you who don't know who I am, I'm Ward Mishner, and I'm a lawyer with the Justice Department here in Yukon. And I hope I've been given the easy job of chairing these proceedings. You may or may not know that there has been a changed agenda, and I would just like to go over that with you now and a couple of other details before we get started. Let's hope I haven't overreached the topic of the agenda. This afternoon, we have Professor Ken Coates and Professor Bill Morrison speaking more or less together, and Professor Bill Gibson.
He's never together.
Tomorrow morning, Ian Binney from the McCarthy firm will be here and speaking along with Bruce Willis and Mr. Justice Lissett will also be speaking tomorrow morning. I believe they will be speaking in the order which I indicated. Tomorrow afternoon, and again this is a change from the most recent agenda, both Professor Gibson and Mr. Coates will be giving an introduction before the politicians get into a discussion of the topic at hand, which appears to be the constitutional status of Yukon. It was very convenient of Mr. Tenneke to arrange to have an election during this time, but so we'll have to see how the politicians perform tomorrow. In addition, I'd just like to point out the social activities. There's a non-cash bar at the Bench and Gavel restaurant after proceedings today, and I would encourage you to attend, especially if you have any questions that you have of the panelists. Tomorrow evening, there is a supper at the Versailles restaurant, and spouses, of course, are invited. I can tell you that there will be little speeches, there will be no head table, it will be a very informal affair. There may be papers that flow from this conference or seminar. I know Mr. Willis has one that he will make available to everybody, and we may have that available by tomorrow. If not, for those that indicate, we will get them printed and delivered to those who so wish to have them. You may have noticed this gentleman back here. This is Mr. Doug White from the Archives Branch, and he is recording these words, and I find it so awesome that even as I speak, my voice is being recorded for posterity. These immortal words. Yes. If you wish, there will be question and answer sessions after the speakers and finish their topics. And of course, you will have a chance to meet them during the social events and otherwise. At this time, I'd like also to acknowledge a couple of other territory guests, part of our panelists. We have from Victoria, Graham Gaughan, which I'd like to stand up there, and Elizabeth Stewart from Galloway, Department of Justice over there. Glad to see you here. The agenda also this afternoon will include a coffee break, I believe after Professors Morrison and Coates finish. That should be sometime around 3 o'clock. What I'd like to do at the present time is just give you a brief introduction to both the professors Morrison and Coates. I'm going to introduce them both together because they have collaborated in the past and because they are two historians we have here, because I just decided to do it that way in any event. Professor Coates has the distinction of being a native Yukoner. He completed his high school here. He took his doctorate at the University of British Columbia. The dissertation was Best Left as Indians, Native-White Relations in Yukon Territory, 1840 to 1950. He is working on several projects, one of which is one that he's entitled Taking the North Down With Her. This involves the story of the sinking of the Princess Sophia in 1911, when 340 people lost their lives. I believe most of them were Yukoners, and I believe at that time it took away about 10% of the non-native population, and had a significant effect on Yukon at that time. He is working also on such projects as Alaska Highway, the first 50 years, white settlers in the 1985 rebellion. He, of course, has attended many conferences and has given talks on such things as the children of Carcross Union Residential School, Robert Kennicott's explorations in the Yukon, and the Hudson State Company and Scientific Knowledge of the Yukon Valley. He has also done research on boom and bust cycles in remote communities. He has several publications. One that I'm sure you're well aware of, one that he did with Professor Morris, is The Land, the Midnight Sun, the History of the Yukon. And he's also published another book, Canada's Colonies, A History of the Yukon and North of its Territories. He has many articles, too numerous for me to mention at the moment, but I think he'll be a very interesting and knowledgeable speaker for us this afternoon. Professor Bill Morrison, received his doctorate at the University of Western Ontario. The subject was Mounted Police on Canada's Northern Frontier, 1895 to 1940. That thesis has been published. He, of course, collaborated with Professor Coates on the history of the Yukon, and is collaborating with him on the sinking of the Princess Sophia project. He is presently on a sabbatical at the University of Victoria, but is a professor of history at Brandon University. He has published such things as a survey of the history of claims, of native claims and peoples of Northern Canada. That was also published in French. He has such papers published as Eagle Over the Arctic, Americans in the Canadian North, Canadian Sovereignty and the Inuit of the Central Eastern Arctic. One entitled More Than a Matter of Blood, the Federal Government, the Churches, and the Mixed Blood Populations of the Yukon McKenzie River Valley, 1870 to 1950. Well, that should be interesting. He also is very well qualified, and I'm sure will prove to be an interesting speaker, so I'll give you both Professor Coates and Morrison.
We're not Siamese twins, even though our CVs are starting to look awfully similar as years go along.
Which one are you?
Coates.
Tell them who you are.
They don't mind Coates. That's Morrison. This is really an interesting opportunity, and one that was approached with a certain amount of trepidation when the request first came through. Gordon and Leanne called and contacted me at different times and said, hey, we've got this neat conference going on, when you come and speak? And lawyers being a rather intimidating bunch, I wasn't quite sure either what I had to say would be of interest, or that it would be terribly kind and gentle to me if I did come and say something at all. And I thought a little while about it, and it struck me as, in fact, an opportunity that is all too seldom taken advantage of. And that is the opportunity for historians to offer their 3.5 cents worth into different gatherings of non-historians, of people who I think stand to benefit from a bit of a historical perspective on contemporary affairs. One of the problems of Meech Lake, I suspect, at least in my mind, is that we tend to see it as a contemporary problem. And in fact, it is only a contemporary manifestation of a very long and well-established issue and problem in Canadian political and constitutional history. What I would like to do, just to sort of explain how I don't have time to go about this, is I would like to talk very quickly, very briefly, about the constitutional traditions in a very broad sort of sense, about between Canada, or the constitutional traditions in Canada and the United States, as regards their peripheral districts, how the United States planned for the incorporation of peripheral districts into union, and how Canada planned for the incorporation of peripheral districts into union or into confederation. And to root this as much as possible in the attitudes and policies and ideas in the two countries regarding the frontier, regarding the periphery. It's not just a political process, it's very much an intellectual and a social and a cultural process. And I think with this kind of understanding, it is somewhat easier to understand what can only be called the insult of Meech Lake. It in fact is not a surprising event, but instead one that is very consistent with the historical treatment of Canada. To start off with a very basic point, and that is that constitutions, well, they're very legal documents, they're very political documents, but they're also historical documents. They reflect the evolution of their country, they reflect the priorities of their countries at different times. The historical evolution of a country, its political structures, its social environment, demonstrates or determines what is possible in a constitutional form, what is legitimate in terms of constitutional change, and in fact also dictates what is necessary. Meech Lake is in fact a reflection of part of that. I think the preoccupation with Quebec is very much an historical phenomenon. In both Canada and the United States, as they dealt with very large peripheral territories, as America sort of added on to its western territories and eventually its northern territories, as Canada added on to its western territories, it had to come up with a solution to a rather troubling problem. How do you deal with peripheral territories? How do you treat them? How do you bring them into the Union? How do you govern them? What sort of constitutional legislative structure do you use? I think if you're looking for a very quick answer to that, you can go back to the way in which Canada and the United States were created, or more particularly, how they separated from Britain, how they separated from a mother country. You have in the United States the American Revolution, in which the Americans reject their role as a peripheral colony, react against being colonized and react against being a peripheral district, and strike back against the mother country through revolution. And it's not surprising then, as you go through the subsequent years and the subsequent generations, to discover that America would carry that revolutionary memory with it. And they would try to find a way of incorporating peripheral districts without repeating the mistakes of the mother country. If you compare that to Canada, Canada did not so much separate through revolution or rebellion, but instead, in one sense, I guess you could almost describe it as devolved. It sort of gradually moved away from Britain, and very much with British encouragement and British assistance. Britain was looking for alternative constitutional arrangements, and Confederation suited British purposes almost as much as it suited Canadian ones. What do you see happening then? Is that as the United States acquires new territories and as they gain new peripheral districts, they try to find a model for development that will avoid Britain's mistakes. In Canada, on the other hand, you have a situation where they don't see Canada's colonial or Britain's colonial model as being an error. They do not see that peripheral structure as being fundamentally flawed. And so instead there is this desire to almost reproduce it, to treat Canada's peripheral districts in a fashion rather reminiscent of the way that Britain had treated its peripheral districts or its colonies in British North America. The U.S. model for constitutional development of the periphery was established in what's called the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. And this ordinance set up the idea that there will be areas that are not ready for statehood or are not yet states or not part of the original 13 colonies. And that these areas will, of course, desire political evolution. They will grow, they will mature, and their population will expand. And there will be some point at which they say, it is time for us to become full members. The question was, well, how do you decide when that will be? How do you decide ahead of time? Can you decide ahead of time on some sort of structure that will tell all those people, go out and live on the frontier, settle the farmland, do the best you can to get rid of the native people using whatever devices you feel comfortable using. They found many to do that, and grow and prosper, knowing full well that when you do, there will be a place for you in the Union. Now, that process was not always smooth. There were places that wanted to become states before the other states wanted them to be states, and it's not a very quick and easy system. But there were rules set down. When you've gone to a certain population, you could apply for statehood. Once you'd apply for statehood, you could start the process of constitutional change. You would write your own state constitution. You would present that constitution to the United States Congress. That process, just by itself, becomes a very, very strong source of regional pride and of state or territorial identity in the United States of America. As each state went through that process, if you look at the sort of textbook histories of almost any state in the Union, you will find this rocky road to statehood sort of as the central theme in their history. Here's how we went from being sort of an unsettled, unpopulated area to being a full member in this great and glorious Union of the United States of America. It's a process that is set out ahead of time. The model is described. And so as people moved on to the periphery, they did so knowing there was a system in place that would eventually allow for their incorporation into the larger Union. It's a system designed to tell everybody that they can aspire to political equality, that there are reasons why they won't get it right away, because the population is too small, the federal government needs to control the land for other purposes or what have you, but it is designed to tell everybody that your time will come. There will be a moment, and we can sort of tell you ahead of time how that process will emerge. Well, Canadians, for a whole bunch of reasons, can't follow that approach and seek a very different one. The reasons, I think, are very simple. The Canadians are not opposed to the British colonial models, I mentioned very quickly before. And sort of flipping that on the other side, there is a strong tradition in Canada of, at that time, hatred for the United States of America, perhaps better described as a fundamental distrust of democracy or republicanism, a fundamental distrust of this idea that the will of the people should have its way, the belief instead that the elite should have some controlling interest in how the country would evolve and what time and place it would change. And also, I think, a fear of key American expansionism. So that Canada's peripheral districts would be controlled and developed with the goal of avoiding some of the American models, of limiting some of that grassroots democratic protest and what have you, and of keeping the Americans at bay. In the years after Confederation brought Ontario, Quebec, and New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia into Union, Ontario and Quebec, particularly Ontario, became particularly anxious to expand their control of peripheral districts, to add new peripheral districts. The acquisition of Hudson Bay Company lands, for example, was very much based on Ontario's need for a hinterland, Ontario's need for an outlet for the West, for a place for its population surplus to expand and grow. From the very beginning, the plan of the federal government and the plan of the people of Ontario, what were called the expansionists of that day, was to keep the West, and the West included everything from Manitoba to the Yukon at that time, as a preserve, as a national preserve, to be developed in the interest of the country as a whole, not to look to the interests of the people who are already in that area, and to be paced with the development of constitutional change would follow national objectives and national criteria and national timetables rather than that of the region itself. It took a resistance, I think maybe what you call it a rebellion at Red River in 1869-70, but a resistance at Red River where the citizens stood up and said, no, in fact, we will not tolerate that kind of centralized colonial model that led to the establishment of Manitoba. And that solved Manitoba's problems in a very narrow sense, but left the rest of the Northwest Territories within the colonial system. The West and the North, then, were there to serve, the standard sort of phrase, were there for the purposes of the Dominion, to be ruled under a British colonial model, or something very close to that in terms of its administrative structures and goals and aspirations. Unlike the American system that told the farmers and the settlers and the developers and the land speculators and everybody else, your time will come, there were no guarantees under the Canadian system that there would be a time, that there would be a moment in which they could all of a sudden say, hey, we're there now, we're ready for partnership, we're ready for equality, we're ready to become constitutional partners in Confederation. As the process evolved, Manitoba in 1870, Saskatchewan, Alberta, 1905, gained provincial status. But they did so in large measure because they already satisfied many of Canada's national objectives in those areas. Canada had settled the area. Canada had kept the United States at bay. There was a population. But it's important to note that those provinces were created unlike the other provinces. They did not get control of natural resources and became, right from the very beginning, second-rank provinces. So there was, even in what appears to be equality, even in the achievement of provincial status, equality remained rather elusive. Control of natural resources came in 1930, afterwards, by which time they had served most of the nation's purposes. The Yukon and the Northwest Territories have inherited this tradition, this pattern of developing Canada, or Canada's peripheral districts, in the interests of the center, through the centralizing influence of Ottawa, with no guaranteed formula for entry. Politicians in Yukon at different times would say, now we're ready for provincial status. The federal government would say no over and over again. And in fact, as the Yukon and Northwest Territories learned back at the turn of the century and learned again under Meech Lake, no assurances that provincial status would ever be theirs. That in fact the resources would be retained again for the purposes of the Dominion. Would remain under federal government control. This is more, I would suggest, though, than just a political or constitutional issue, more than just an attitude, or more than just, reflects more than just how Canada versus the United States views the constitutional questions of peripheral districts. I think it also says a tremendous amount about the different attitudes in Canada and the United States toward the frontier. In a Canadian context, they use the word north instead of frontier, I suspect. The American attitude toward the frontier is fairly simple. The ideology of the frontier is one of growth, is one of prosperity, it's one of opportunity. In the American rhetoric through the 19th century and into the early 20th century, the frontier was synonymous with wealth, synonymous with growth, synonymous with potential, and even synonymous with freedom, a place where Americans could discover what America was really all about. There's an awful lot of fallacies built into that kind of rhetoric. It wasn't exactly the way things worked out, and the frontier was not as free and not as liberal and not as egalitarian as the myth would have us believe. But it very much was a myth in the United States, a myth about how they saw their country, how they saw their future. It's fascinating, for example, when the Americans purchased Alaska in 1867, that we often get caught up with that wonderful phrase about Seward's Folly, and everybody was saying what a great mistake this was to spend all that kind of money. In fact, a very interesting assessment of newspaper reaction to the purchase of Alaska was, in fact, overwhelmingly positive. They weren't opposed to spending whatever it was, $7 million and change, for Alaska. In fact, people immediately started saying, this is a land of opportunity. This is a land of growth and potential. We don't know what's up there, but because it's the frontier, it's likely to be good. And it's likely to be grand, and it's America's, and so it will be free and prosperous forever. Alaska gave lots of evidence that that wasn't necessarily so, but the Alaskans, Americans, I think, approached it very differently. In Canada, our rhetoric about the frontier is very different. And I would suggest that our rhetoric about the frontier, and it's much safer to say this here in Whitehorse than it is to say this kind of thing down in Victoria, where I have to say it more often than not, is that rhetoric about the frontier is filled with hypocrisy. Hypocrisy about our country, hypocrisy about our frontier, and hypocrisy about our north. North, Nordicity, to use a phrase of a geographer, suffuses almost every aspect of Canadian nationalism. It's not a trick that hockey and curling are some of the great Canadian sports, instead of squash and racquetball or something indoors and warm. As early as the 19th century, when Canada was evolving as a country and trying to come to grips with what it meant to be Canadian, the Canadian intellectuals came up with all sorts of wonderful themes about how the North made us a strong and a hardy breed. It was a cold wind blowing down from Hudson Bay that gave Canadians their fortitude and their strength and their determination and their persistence. If you look through our contemporary culture, you will find that fascination with the Northland continues. It continues in the fact that people continue to buy Pierre Burton's books. That Farley Mowat becomes a national cult hero, spends more time talking about him in Toronto than he does way up to the North to find out about it. That everything from the Group of Seven to Ted Harrison find ready markets for their northern stock. That the Inuit artists have become almost an international symbol of Canada. The simplicity, the relationship with the environment, and what have you. There is that wonderful Nordicity that Canadians are so proud of. And all those jokes that even people in British Columbia make about Americans who come to the border in the middle of July with their fur parkas on and going up to Shan Canada. But beyond that is the simple reality that Canadians do not believe the rhetoric. They offer the rhetoric, they share the rhetoric. John Diefenbaker talked about a Northland strong and free and all this kind of stuff. But they don't do anything about it. More than 90% of Canada's population lives within 100 miles of the Canada-US border. And more than half, well over half of Canada's population is south of the 49th parallel. Everybody in this room knows how few Canadians live north of the 60th parallel in this country, or even the subarctic regions below. Our relationship as a country to the frontier has, I would suggest, been that of hypocrisy and short-sightedness, of wrapping ourselves up in it because it gives us a strong and a self-confident view of ourselves, but staying away from it because, in fact, it's too cold. It's too far to go. The government of Canada, from the very beginning, has not been prepared to risk the money or the time or the resources in the north, largely because they didn't have those resources. Spending as much money as they possibly could to develop the prairies, they didn't have the resources to offer to the Yukon Northwest Territory. I would suggest to you that some of the money that Canada now spends in the north, that builds law court buildings and things like that, is offered almost out of a sense of national guilt. It's easier to pay to give the Yukon and the Northwest Territories the facilities they need than it is to actually think about developing them or being part of them or incorporating them into the nation in any systematic way. One of the best examples of that is the Prince of Wales Heritage Center in Fairbanks, in Yonah, which when I remember watching the national advertising on that particular program, on that particular opportunity, venture, and it was almost all based on guilt. We have the O'Keefe Center. They in the Yonah have nothing. They have no culture. Wonderful phrase, and Native people loved it when they used that. And it sold, it raised lots of money in Toronto. The people of Canada have shared that hypocritical vision, and the people of Canada have shared that short-sightedness with regards to the North. Canadians have not, as a people, been prepared to go north, to risk their time or their money in the region. It is not at all surprising that the vast majority of Klondike Stampeders were Americans and not Canadians. A very small number of Canadians came north. It is also very significant, to build on this wonderful sort of list we keep going every time we find something, of how many times the Americans assume that the Klondike was part of American history. And in fact, Dawson City was part of Alaska. The reason, very simply, is that Dawson City does not sound like something that could possibly happen in Canada. The Klondike couldn't have happened here. It had to be American because it was fun, energetic, and exciting. For most Canadians, the North was simply another area of the country that Canada could not afford to develop properly and would have to wait its turn. In terms of monetary expenditures, that term would come after World War II. In terms of constitutional development, that, of course, is the purpose of our discussion over the next day or so. You have, then, two contradictory approaches to the North. Americans see the North as land of opportunity. Those who come north in full expectation that they will have or achieve political equality. They come north in full expectation that when conditions are right with regards to population and stability and economic development, that they can aspire to statehood. And they know the foreigners hold out no such expectations. As a country, we have approached the North as a colony, looking upon it for resources that it might in fact offer in the short term, but being prepared to make any long-term commitments because after all, the lines do close down. The expectation was that Ottawa would retain control and that Ottawa would maintain responsibility. Now, Bill will in just a couple of seconds come on and talk about the Yukon situation and sort of how constitutional change developed in the Yukon Territory. But I want to just give a very quick overview of what happens in Alaska. Because Alaska is an interesting counterbalance because it shares an awful lot of common location, distance from Washington to Ottawa and what have you. And I think it also gives you an indication of the different attitudes, because I would suspect that the difference in attitudes among the people are perhaps more important or equally important to the political and constitutional issues. What do the people of Alaska expect when they arrive there? What do the people of the Yukon expect when they arrive there? Well, self-rule does not come perhaps as quickly as Alaskans would have liked. One of the things Alaskans discovered when they first got up to the north was that the United States of America was quite interested in preserving Alaska as something of a national preserve. They liked all those big trees and the big mountains and the big rivers and things like that. And the American government was actually quite concerned that if developers were let loose in Alaska, they'd tear everything up and build oil wells and all that kind of stuff too quickly. So you get a bit of reluctance on the part of the federal government to pass on control to Alaska as quickly as they would have liked. And you get a tension now between the expectations and aspirations of the people of Alaska and the different priorities of the people, the politicians in Ottawa. But the politicians in Alaska from the very beginning, led by men like James Wickersham, pressed for changes. And pressed for changes repeatedly on the assumption that those changes were inevitable and just and would come simply within a matter of time. They were pressing or demanding things that they knew they had every right in the world to expect. And it was only a question of convincing the United States authorities that the time was right now, as opposed to some later measure. Territorial legislature was granted to Alaska in 1912 with a substantial measure of self-government. It was not complete self-government. The United States Congress retained control of such areas as some natural resources, control of liquor. Federal governments always knew that liquor was important in northern development and knew were wise enough to keep revenue from that area to themselves. The pressure for change continued. The first statehood bill, first demand for statehood in Alaska came in 1916. Now, it was a bit of a white flag, I guess. It wasn't a well-formulated statehood proposal, but it was more or less to put the idea on the table, to say, here, Alaska is here, Alaska is maturing. By 1916, Alaska's population was about 100,000 or so, and Alaska had reason to expect that, in fact, now was the time that they could anticipate some sort of political change. There were problems within Alaska itself. Alaska has a rather interesting struggle that you're probably familiar with between the southeast corner of the panhandle and the rest of Alaska. They've always sort of wondered why they couldn't just divide and have two different territories or two different colonies. After World War II, when you get another massive infusion of American settlement in Alaska because of post-World War II military buildup, we get a rather interesting phenomenon. We get a group that have been described as the little men of Alaska. I suspect it's a sexist historian who wrote that, because there were women who were agitating the change as well. These little men of Alaska, as they were called, were simply transplanted Americans who got to Alaska and said, why aren't we equal? Why don't we have the same rights as everybody else? And through the 1950s, they simply demanded, as a matter of right, as American citizens, that they would get full privileges as Americans. The constitutional question heated up again through the 1950s, and again, as we see with Wickersham's statehood bill in 1916 and the establishment of the territorial legislature, these constitutional battles become a major focus for regional identity. Alaskans start feeling hard done by, but they also start feeling like Alaskans, which is a rather positive, I think, development that comes out of this whole process. The Alaskans also in the 1950s adopted a rather interesting model or an interesting plan called the Tennessee Plan. One of the great difficulties that different peripheral areas had in the United States was getting the central government to agree that now, in fact, was the perfect time to become a state within the Union. And what Tennessee had done much earlier is they had said, well, if you guys don't think it's the right time, we're just going to go ahead and do it. And what Tennessee did was they elected their own senators and they drafted up their own constitution and went to Washington and said, here you go, guys. We've done this. I say this today, not when Tony Fanning gets around in case he gets into abuse. And the Alaskans did exactly the same thing in the 1950s. They did the Tennessee Plan. They elected their own senators and their own representatives. At that point, they had one delegate to the House of Representatives. They elected two. And they elected one senator. And these guys went on to Washington and said, here we are. We've got a constitution. We want to belong. And they said, no, you can't come in. Knock on the door. Sorry, guys. That's like 20 when he was down at the First Minister's Conference, so peeping in the window. They wouldn't let them in, but it did tell Americans, it's a wonderful way of embarrassing Americans and saying, you know, you are denying basic constitutional rights. to people within your dominion. They carried their case to Ottawa over and over again, and of course Alaskan statehood was granted in 1959.
The process in Alaska, though, I think is an interesting one because it illustrates brings those two sort of forces together.
One is the positive attitude toward the frontier that says the frontier is a land of opportunity, and people that go there expecting they will in fact become full Americans. The other pattern is that pattern based on the Northwest Ordinance that says those peripheral areas can in fact expect to move logically toward integration, that there will be a point at which they become part of the United States of America. As Bill will describe, the same pattern simply is not more true in the Yukon Territory.